Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 27, Episode 21. Coming up on this show, we've got the last prophecy of a Bulgarian mystic, Lemurian crystal reactor meltdowns, and the galactic wave zodiac cipher. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Is this that galactic wave that some of the New Age stories we've been covering refers to?
Yes, it's something that you will see over and over again if you've ever paid attention to channelers, New Age ramblers,
yep.
Contactees from yep. the 1950s, you know, just
automatic writing in some circumstances.
And Bulgarian mystics from the 1940s, funnily enough. This idea that there's some kind of approaching galactic wave.
Mm-hmm.
Various sources call it the photon belt. Some channeled source from space called it the Geyser Zone 13 or something on the last show. But the general idea is the same, that we're... The some moving force through the galaxy is about to enter our solar system. And when it does, it creates massive changes to humankind.
Right. And often we've heard it being described as it's going to be positive and everyone's going to raise their consciousness. It's all going to be great. But that isn't necessarily the case, right?
Well, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be good for some, bad for others. It depends on the source. But what I find really fascinating is that so many different people from different spectrums of weirdness.
Yeah.
All seem to be talking about the same thing, but also from different timelines as well. I mean, different periods of history.
Yeah. So even though they describe it in different contexts, it seems to be describing the same phenomenon.
Yes. And you can even go back to some ancient sources, and if you read between the lines, they might be talking about the same thing. So I did a deep dive today. I looked at this Bulgarian mystic, Peter Duonov. I looked into his work because, I mean, he was born in 1864 and he was talking about this in the early 1900s. And then I've followed this thread to some real scientific discoveries in the last 20 years that show that these galactic waves are very real. We've observed them in other galaxies. And back when they were first discovered in the 1970s, it was initially thought that they would occur in other galaxies every 10 million years or something. We don't have to worry about it. It's very rare that a galactic core will pulse out with a big explosion.
But galactic waves of what? Are they electric particles?
Every form of energy you can think of.
Oh, is it radiation? Is it dangerous?
Every kind of radiation you can think of. And yes, it's very dangerous. And initially, as I was saying, the thinking was, okay, every 10 million years, every 100 million years, this happens. But then later they discovered that, oh, there's evidence this could have occurred as little as 10,000 years ago.
Oh, and that kind of aligns with certain ancient sites that are around 12,000 years ago.
It puts it in the neighborhood of certain weird timings in our history.
The Younger Dryas?
Yeah, things like that.
Okay.
So I'm going to go into that. It's long and complicated and super fun.
Brilliant.
So what have you got coming up?
Well, I ended up going into Dick Sutphin's recently re-released book. He's doing Sedona Psychic Energy Vortexes. And I thought, isn't Dick Sutphin now deceased? And it turns out, yes, he is.
You said that in such a happy way.
No, I wasn't being happy. I was confused. Just thought, why does he have a new book? But it's not necessarily a new book. It's a reprint of these experiences that he has collected of people that have gone to Sedona. And he used to run these seminars. And essentially, it was more than a seminar. He would just get a group of, essentially, for the most part, psychically sensitive people together. And they would conduct these psychic experiments. They would try and remote view. They would conduct past life regressions. They would do ESP. They would try anything they could to try and get a greater understanding of what was going on at Sedona. Now, of course, Sedona in Arizona is a location that is known to be very unusual, has strange energies. Dick Sutphin himself says, look, there's four magnetic, electronic style energy vortices here that you can encounter some very unusual things. And I must say, because it was Dick Sutphen, I think the last time we covered him, he ended up having a past life regression where he was hunting down a previous version of himself to have sex with.
No, so, that was one of...
so...
No, that's not at all what happened. That was someone that he was interviewing.
Oh, someone who was interviewing.
It was the same scenario about a year ago. They did a reprint of Dick Sutphen's book on past lives. And it was something, I can't remember the title, but it was specifically about past life love.
That's right.
And I remember the cover for that episode because I mocked up a Mills and Boone novel as the cover for the show because it was so corny. It was all these corny love stories about people's past life dalliances. There was one example. He brought forward this idea that because he claims he came across several individuals who understood that they had incarnations that had been split in their current life.
That's right, yes.
There was a version of them living in Australia and at the same time there was like a version of them who was like an old man in China. And it's the same guy. It's the same person, same soul.
Same incarnation.
But they've just done this weird split incarnation. So this one guy, this young guy, realized through this hypnotic regression that his soul, his other part of his soul was a hot French girl living in Paris. And so, of course, as you remember, he wanted to travel there and go and meet himself and possibly do other things. Mm. That was the last time you mentioned Dick Sutphen.
I'm being a little bit unfair to Dick, but perhaps the reason why I raise that, though, is because much of this particular book, it's very love and light. It's all very positive. It's all very actually fitting with your work, Ben. Raise your consciousness, you know, interact with higher beings. It's all positive. But if you just kind of peel back the layers, you find that there are a few stories in there that suggest that everything isn't rosy out at Sedona. There's something else going on. And we find that there was a terrible catastrophe or a disaster that took place in Sedona eons ago. And what this left was essentially a pulsating power crystal that is now lying on its side, potentially ripping holes in space-time reality.
Still active.
Still active.
It's like Chernobyl.
It's like Chernobyl. It's radioactive. Psychically, and what it's doing,
psychically,
and what it's doing, it might explain why there's weird things going on, like Bradshaw Ranch. It might explain why it links in back to these ley lines. I've got this crazy story of where a whole bunch of people were dematerialized at Stonehenge. It's all because this idea, all these ley lines that are around the world. When you think of ley lines, and when we talk about them, we tend to describe them as being these constant streams of energy, but that's not necessarily so. They're not always having energy running through them. Sometimes they have to be activated. Sometimes it has to happen spontaneously. And unfortunately, anything that's in the way of that line can have weird phenomenon take place and they can get sucked into it. They can have weird things appear. And it's what's occurring at Sedona might explain why this happens and why, you know, we hear these stories of there's like flaps. There's periods of weird disappearances. There's periods of UFOs showing up. There's periods of strange entities showing up in people's neighborhoods and bothering them for years, and then nothing.
It's because the old crystal Chernobyl is pulsing away.
Power slows down. It stops. And then it has to be recharged once up again to cause the energy to start releasing things.
Okay, that sounds suitably insane.
So that is very insane. That's coming up in our Plus extension at the end of the show.
Well, let's go into the work of Peter Dunov. It's D-E-U-N-O-V.
That sounds right.
Dunov?
I'm not sure, but that sounds right.
It's got to be close.
We'll go with that.
He was born Peter Konstantinov Dunov on the 12th of July, 1864, the youngest of three children of a priest, Konstantin Dunovsky. And I'm going to pull out a bit of his biography from this book by David Lorimer. It's called The Prophet of Our Times, His Life and Teachings, because I want to set the backstory of this guy and because we've never spoken about him on the show, but there's this final prophecy he gave before he died, which will get us into the whole photon belt idea.
Okay.
We don't know too much about his early years, but we know he became a teacher in a small village in Bulgaria. Eventually, he left for the United States in August of 1888. He studied at this Methodist Institute of Theology and eventually enrolled at the Faculty of Medicine in Madison, New England. He stayed in America for 7 years, finished his studies, went back to Bulgaria in 1895. There's only a couple of stories from him, from people that knew him in his time in America, but they're all really strange.
Okay.
There's this one strange incident written by a writer, Grabalshev, who was also studying in America, another Bulgarian guy. They became friends, and Dunov, because it gets confusing because he used this spiritual name later on called Bienza Duono. I'm just going to call him Dunov. Dunov invited him on this excursion, and they were making their way through this thick forest, I presume in New England somewhere. And this guy wrote about how they eventually emerged into this meadow, and there's this strange lake in the middle of the forest, this beautiful sparkling lake with a house right next to it, like this old fashioned, beautiful house. And this boatman suddenly appeared and took them in the boat to the other side of the lake where the house was. And they were met, he said, by a group of strange silent people who greeted Dunov with this tremendous respect, like he was some kind of master or something. Now, Dunov basically told his friend, whatever you do, just don't really talk. Let me do all the talking. Just observe and everything will be all right. So they're invited in for refreshments. They're taken into this large hall with a strange long table with 13 chairs around it. And they're all sitting around this table. And again, his friend is warned by Dunov not to ask any questions and not to record any of the proceedings. So he wasn't allowed to write about anything that took place. So all we know is that this meeting happened and that he couldn't say anything about it. After the meeting, the two young men return home. And then a few days later, this friend of his, Grabalshev, is really curious about this house and this lake. He wants to go back. So he treks out on his own this time. He goes back into the forest. He follows the same trail. He's been down it 1,000 times, but he cannot find this lake. Oh, he spends days going back trying to find this lake and this house. He just cannot find it. It's not on any maps. No one else has ever heard of it. Everyone looks at him like he's crazy when he mentions this lake in the middle of the forest. It's like they went to another dimension.
Preston Dennett has a very similar story out of Arizona, like an actual disappearing house.
Really?
Yeah. It's like some weird interdimensional rift.
We've covered plenty of stories like that over the years.
But they're normally in the UK. They tend to be kind of, you know, like a British thing for some reason.
A lot of cases from the UK. Anyway, he returns to Bulgaria, Dunov, and he completes his doctoral dissertation. It's called Science and Education. But most of the time during this period, he was apparently in seclusion and meditation. He spent a lot of time in prayer and just solitude. And then in 1897, he experienced some kind of mystical initiation. The details on this are scant.
Oh, that's a shame.
There's nothing that we know. All we know is that he received some instructions for his mission.
What, remotely? Did it come from a channeled source? None of that's
no idea. Mentioned. Maybe he went to a special cave and jumped on a crystal. I don't know. In October of 1898, he then delivered this proclamation. It's called A Call to My People. And he did this to this small society in Varna in Bulgaria. He said, I have come from above on the command of God, who has assigned me the mission of warning you to turn away from the evil path and to preach to you the truth of life, which comes from the heavenly dwellings of eternal light, a truth which will enlighten every mind, renew every heart, and uplift and refresh every spirit. He says, I have arrived in this decaying world at a very important moment to assert the necessary influence to lead you away from this wild path towards which the nations of the world are mindlessly rushing. Pretty broad mission statement, you'd have to say. And then in 1900, he forms this institute. It's called the Fellowship of Light. He holds their first convention on the 6th of April in Varna in Bulgaria. Huge turnout. There was three people there. And he said to them, now you are only three people, but you will soon be many. The hall is not empty. The chairs are occupied by invisible beings. Today is the first convention of the White Brotherhood in Bulgaria. Now you are only three men, but you will become thousands. And that's precisely what happened. When he passed away in 1944, He had 40,000 followers, and there are 144 study circles around the country.
Wasn't it, I'm just looking at my notes here, wasn't it Ledbetter that was describing the White Brotherhood at one moment as well? He was talking about talismans.
Exactly. The Theosophists spoke a lot about the White Brotherhood.
In fact, it fits in with what I was talking about with Sedona, of there being these certain power locations, power accumulators around the world for this ley line energy, because I believe with Ledbetter, he was either tasked or he sent someone with these talismans to go around the world and bury them in certain locations to act as amplifiers of that energy. And it was like the White Brotherhood had given him this information and these secret talismans to do so.
Was that Ledbetter?
It was Ledbetter.
Yeah, I remember you covering that. The Theosophists did that in Russia and other places as well. Well, because he went to America, I wonder if he got in with the Theosophists.
But that's what I'm thinking.
It's been conveniently left out of his biography.
Well,
but I mean, the guy went on to be prolific. He's got like a Steiner type character where he released thousands and thousands and thousands of lectures. Like, he just wrote so much or lectured so much. And there's all these stories about the guy, which is why I wanted to spend some time talking about him, which are just bizarre. So at the early stage, when he didn't have many disciples, a lot of the first disciples kind of didn't trust him too much. They're like, oh, this guy's interesting, but is he really who he says he is? Is he really something special? During a meeting, he was about to give a lecture, and one of these people made a remark that, oh, he knows a lot about spiritual things, but maybe he's just read more books than me. If I read the same books, I would know a lot more. I mean, what's so special? Mm. And then shortly afterwards, it's almost like, dude, the master's standing behind you right now. It's like one of those moments where he just came in the door as the guy was telling the story.
He's right behind me, isn't he?
It's a little bit like that. So Dunov, he walks in and he just looks at everyone in the room. And he takes a key and locks the door for the room he's just walked into, this hall that they're meeting in. He places the key on the table and then sits down in his seat. And he's just looking at them all, and he makes eye contact with the guy that was the doubter. And then he just vanishes. He just disappears in front of all of them. There's like 12 people in the room.
Okay.
And they're just, what the hell? They're all freaking out. And they just hear this knock on the door. And it's Dunov. They don't answer it, but he's like, it's me. Hello, I'm at the door. Can you all hear me? And they're like, yeah, we can hear you. Then he's back in the chair. He's like, here you go. I'm back in the chair in front of you again. And then he does it again. Disappears. Hello, I'm outside the house now. Hey, I'm back in the chair.
So he's obviously mastered this ability.
He does this like four or five times and they're all like, we get it. We get it. Stop. Eventually he says, remember, I am with you and among you, but I am not like you. There's another story of one of his followers who was a train driver, and he once accidentally fell asleep at the controls of the train, and he was coming into a station he was meant to stop at, and he was flying. He was going really fast. And eventually he wakes up to the sound of the train whistle, and he looks over, and Dunov is driving the train. And he's like, choo-choo.
It's like Third Man Effect kind of stuff.
Yeah, he's fully driving the train. He's got the hat on and everything.
Don't worry about it, my boy.
And this guy just, like, comes out of his sleepiness and is about to say thank you, and he disappears.
That's cool.
There's all these stories like this. There's another one from this widow. She found herself in dire straits. She had children to feed. She had no prospects, no job, no one to look after her, and she was just at the end, and she decided to commit suicide. She wanted to poison herself and just, you know, get out of this misery. And just as she's got this cup of poison, she's about to commit the deed, this strange man she doesn't know suddenly appears in her flat out of nowhere, just like the door's still locked. He's just in her living room, and he goes and snatches the glass off her, and he's like, what are you doing? Why do you wish to die? Are you mad? And the widow basically described her situation, and he's listening intently. And he gives her a bit of comfort and finally tells her that her situation is going to improve. Now, because of this strange man appearing in her living room, and he leaves, he says good day and he leaves.
Is he just monitoring though for people that are depressed? I mean, why would he focus on her?
Well, good question. She decides, because of this meeting, to not take her life, obviously. And after this mysterious encounter, she miraculously gets a job. It's enough money to feed her children, pay for her rent. And one day she happens to find herself at Izgrev, which was later on the center of this brotherhood that he created. And she sees that weird old man that turned up in her apartment. And she's like, it's you, what are you doing here? And someone else said, oh, that's Dunov, that's our master. So he had just, this random guy, he had just appeared and saved her from suicide. There's another story, it's a similar vein, of this Bulgarian worker who had gone to America. He had gone to earn some money and then come back to Bulgaria because he was married and had a kid. But after a while, his wife didn't hear from him. And every letter she sent wasn't answered. And she was just really, really concerned. It turned out he had married another woman in America and decided never to return to Bulgaria. He was just going to abandon his wife and kid.
What a jerk.
And one day she had approached Dunov and he just unloaded this story on him and just said, oh, my husband's abandoned me. He's gone to America and he's with some hussy. It's just this terrible situation. I don't know what to do. I've begged him to come back and he won't answer my letters. And from that day on, the husband in America, every day this weird old man he had never met, who had a Bulgarian accent, would knock on his door. It would be like 5 a.m. He's open his door. There's this weird old man.
Is he going to annoy him back to his wife?
And the old man just keeps saying, you've got to go back to your wife. You've got to go back to your kid. You're being very selfish. Go back to Bulgaria. And he just slams the door. He's like, who are you? Go away. Next day, knock, 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 knock. You've got to go back to your wife. And this annoying old man turned up every single day for weeks until finally this Bulgarian guy's like, oh, fine. I'm going to go back to Bulgaria and I'm going to go back to my first wife and child and look after them. So he catches the steamship to go back to Bulgaria. And he's in his cabin and he hears this knock on the door. And he opens the cabin of the steamship and it's the same old man saying, make sure you go back to Bulgaria.
I bought a steamship. What else could I do?
Where else am I going to go? Exactly. And this happened day after day. It drilled into his head by this strange old man that he needed to go back to his wife and kids. So eventually he goes back to his wife and he tells his wife the story. And she says, you know, I bet I know who that old man is. And then a few weeks later, they're at Izgrev, they're visiting family, and he spots Dunov at the center and says, that's the guy, that's the old man that was turning up to my house every day in America. So they go and she introduces him. And he's like, it's you. What, have you been to America lately? And he just has this smile on his face and says, not for a while. Haven't been to America in years. But, you know, with this cheeky grin.
Has abilities.
So he's teleporting everywhere, this crazy old man.
Mm.
From 1905 to 1926, he was based in the Bulgarian capital of Sofia. And again, he would draw huge crowds and give these massive lectures. Often he had to speak next to a window because the hall would be filled with so many people that everyone would be congregating outside. He gave some 7,000 lectures in 30 years. Two-thirds of them have been recorded in 150 volumes in Bulgarian.
Wow.
He also developed a series of calisthenics and exercises that would be coupled with his teachings. So the idea was that his followers would stay fit and they would do all these aerobic-type exercises. He wanted to keep them strong and supple. And they did lots of 5 a.m. starts climbing mountains. It's really kind of intense what they were doing. And he was a healer as well. So there's all these stories of him healing, but his approach was always to get people to raise their thoughts to a higher plane. There's a quote from him saying, purity of thoughts, feelings, desires, and the body is a condition for health. But again, just weird, paranormal, miracle type stories associated with him. There's one from this guy who was an employee of the post office, and his wife fell gravely ill. So he wrote a letter to Dunov because he wanted to get a remedy from him. He wanted some medical advice because remember, he studied medicine when he was in America. So he writes this letter and he addresses it to the master and he puts it in an envelope and puts it in his jacket and off he goes to work. And when he gets to his office at the post office, there's a telegram waiting for him. Like a telegram's already arrived. And he opens the telegram and it's from Dunov And it's saying, sorry to hear about your wife. Here's the full remedy you'll need, and make sure you give it this three times a day.
So it was almost precognitive.
And he's like, I haven't even sent the letter yet. What the hell's going on? Like, he's still got the letter in his jacket. And no one could have known, because his wife only just got sick and they're in like a different city. It's bizarre. So he did the treatment, and his wife got better after a couple of days. There's some guy who had an infection in his eye and he was starting to go blind, and Dunov just came up to him and went like monkey magicked his hands in front of his eye for 5 minutes, and then it was totally healed. There's a story like that. There's another guy who had appendicitis and he was really stubborn. He said, I'm not going to get medical treatment, and I'm really confident the master's going to heal me. And all his friends are like, you're crazy. You got to go to the doctor. Your appendix is going to burst. You're an idiot. And he's like, no, he's really stubborn. He's like, I'm not going to the doctor. And according to the story, Dunov was in the middle of a lecture that day. And he's talking to thousands and thousands of people. And all these eyewitnesses say, in the middle of the lecture, he just stopped talking and started to stare into the distance. And then this look came over his face like, oh, crap, I don't have much time. And witnesses say he fled the lecture hall, like started running. And he actually ran to this guy's house. Now,
what, like he was, but was he looking at something? Was he somehow accessing information?
It's like he got an SMS message in his head.
Yeah.
And he just knew that this idiot who wasn't going to the hospital was going to die. And it would look bad. It obviously looked bad for him. So he runs down to this guy's house, and it's only like, I don't know, 20-minute jog away. And the eyewitnesses in the house said he somehow poured some concoction out of thin air. Like, he had a glass and he somehow like manifested this jug and poured this strange liquid into like a mug for this guy. Now, he gives this guy with the bad appendix this drink, and the guy said it was like drinking liquid fire. He was like, like screaming. It was so painful. But when they turned around, Dunov was already running back to give his lecture, to finish his lecture. Now, this guy claims, yeah, it was like drinking lava, but after 3 days, he was totally healed. So there's tons of stories like this. There's all these weird teleportation stories. But in January of 1944, after the bombing of Sofia in Bulgaria, he had to move. So they ended up moving near Mount Vatosha. So they really got out into the wilderness. And they say he realized that conditions for his mission were basically ending, right? The favorable conditions were on the decline. Mm-hmm. And in October of 1944, he was visited by this Konstantinov, this follower or a colleague or a peer. They don't say who this guy is, but essentially Dunov announced to him, I have accomplished my task on Earth and soon I'm going to leave. And he was like, where are you going? Are you going back to America? He says, no, I'm done here. I'm going to leave. Now, a few days before his final departure, Konstantinov visited him again. And he asked him if he was going to stay a little longer, because he kind of got it this time. He's like, look, master, are you going to stay a little bit longer in the physical world? And Dunov looked at him and essentially gave him this negative gesture as if to say, no, it's not going to happen. And some of his last words to this guy were, it is only with and through love that the world will be set to rights. He says, for my part, I'm leaving. My work will continue on the other side. You don't have much time left. Be vigilant and do not be discouraged. You must all progress with great enthusiasm. May peace be with you. A small task has been completed. Now, he breathed his last at 6 o'clock on the morning of December the 27th, 1944. And 2 days after his death, the communists turn up at his center where everyone was. And they had come to arrest him and potentially torture him and or kill him or put him in a gulag forever. So
it's like he knew.
It's like he knew that. Again, the situation was declining. The possibility of him continuing to teach wasn't a possibility.
But then we have to ask the question, did he actually die or did he transmute himself?
No, he's dead. It's not like an Indian guru where they're like, no, he's just having a rest, buddy. No, he was dead. Like, they laid out his body and he got an actual funeral. But the timing was so precise. He knew exactly when they were going to come for him, and he checked out. He's like, that's it. I'm checking out.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm also asking. Did he commit suicide, or is it just that it's like...
No, here's the thing. The doctor that examined him, this is according to the quote, said he had never encountered such a virgin organism in 50 years of medical practice, which is saying that he
hasn't trashed his body.
He was in perfect condition. Yeah. It didn't make sense that he had passed away. It didn't make sense that he had died. And we've heard stories like this from the Tibetan monks.
Yes.
Who have a certain practice where they announce when they're going to die, and then they have a ritual, which is like 60 days or something, where they prepare for it. And it leads to a certain state of mummification for the body. But the...
Well, it's almost like they become the incorruptibles. Not completely, but you're right. There is this mummification.
But the link is that there's this knowledge of the time of departure.
Yes.
A very clear knowledge. So the book is full of these unique spiritual teachings he gave in his lectures, because not too much of it has been translated from Bulgarian. I don't want to focus on that today, but I'll link to it if you want to check it out, if you're interested in his work. But I did want to focus on his last prophecy. So this was days before that final departure where he said to his friend, I'm checking out. They say he was in this trance, and he essentially gave this prophecy, which his students wrote down, about this epoch that we're crossing into and the coming of a new age for humanity. Now, I saw this recently in the newest issue of Nexus magazine, which is why I was reading about this guy today. And this is the last prophecy of Peter Dunov. He said, during the passage of time, the consciousness of humankind has traversed a very long period of obscurity. This phase, which the Hindus called Kali Yuga, is on the verge of ending. He said, we find ourselves today at the frontier between two epochs, the Kali Yuga and the new era we are entering. A gradual improvement is already occurring in the thoughts, sentiments, and acts of humans, but everybody will soon be subjugated to a divine fire that will purify and prepare them in regarding to the new era. Oh, crap.
Oh, I say bring it on.
Here we go. Thus, humankind will raise itself to a superior degree of consciousness indispensable to its entrance to this new life. That is what one understands by ascension. Some decades will pass before this fire will come that will bring a transformation to the world by bringing it a new morality. This immense wave comes from cosmic space and will inundate the entire Earth. There it is. This immense wave.
But it's metaphorical, right?
No, he's talking about an actual cosmic wave. He says all those who attempt to oppose it will be carried off and transferred elsewhere. This is exactly what we described in the last plot show.
They shoved into the portal.
All these wacky people believe that there's some portal in Antarctica, and in 2024 or 2023, all the world's elites are going to be kicked into this portal and transported to another world in the galaxy and forever be banished from the human realm.
There'll be food there. They'll be able to survive, but they're banished.
It's the same idea. He says this new wave will be felt by each one of us. This transformation will not only touch the Earth, but the entire cosmos. The best and only thing that humanity can do now is to turn towards God and improve itself consciously to elevate, so as to find itself in harmony with this powerful wave that will soon submerge it. Everything that is around you will soon collapse and disappear, he says. Nothing will be left of this civilization or its perversity. The entire Earth will be shaken, and no trace will be left of this erroneous culture. And this is where he gets more specific, okay? He says our solar system is now traversing a region of the cosmos where a constellation that was destroyed left its mark, its dust. This crossing of contaminated space is a source of poisoning, not only for the inhabitants of the Earth, but for all the inhabitants of other planets of our galaxy. Only the suns are not affected by this influence. This region is called the 13th zone. One also calls it the zone of contradictions. Our planet was enclosed in this region for thousands of years, but finally we are approaching the exit of this, and we are on the point of attaining a more spiritual region where more evolved beings live. So there's two ideas happening. there's this cosmic force about to come, but we're also, our solar system is entering a new region of space, and we're exiting this previous area that was full of all this cosmic dust from a supernova. That's what he's saying, like an exploded constellation, he says. And as I'll reveal in a few minutes, that's fact.
Really?
Our solar system is exiting this cosmic dust type area and entering into a new zone. The reason we know it is because of the Voyager.
Yeah, the space probe.
And the calculations of how far they are now. They're apparently getting beyond this.
The outer layer of our
layer we are now and into this new area. And I'll link to a science article in the show notes that talks about this in more detail. Essentially, they're just kind of entering the outer layers of what we're eventually all going to move into.
Is this cyclic, or is this just how we move through space? Obviously, our solar system is cyclic, but is our solar system on some other... I mean, obviously, we're moving around with the Milky Way, but is it moving just through space randomly? I'm just wondering, does it line up with the Kala Yugas? Does it line up with...
Well, he does mention the Yugas there, and that will become clear later. It's a good question. I think, naturally, you'd assume yes.
Mm.
But I'll have more details on that in a moment. So he says when we exit this area and enter this new zone in our galaxy, because of these cosmic forces, he says there will be floods, hurricanes, gigantic fires and earthquakes that will sweep away everything. Blood will flow in abundance and there will be revolutions, terrible explosions will resound in numerous regions of the Earth. Where there is Earth, water will come. Where there is water, Earth will come. He says we are dealing here with a chastisement, a reply by nature against the crimes perpetrated by humanity since the night of time against its mother, the Earth. He says the new era is that of the sixth race. The sixth race will build itself around the idea of fraternity. There will be no more conflicts of personal interests. The single aspiration of each one will be to conform to the law of love.
Oh, no.
But this sixth race thing is interesting because this suggests a new human being. If we think of the human race as the fifth race, the sixth race is a new human being. So this force that he says we're going to encounter will change us fundamentally. And again, what's weird, this is exactly what the wacky New Agers talk about when they talk about the photon belt. Because they say it's like, it's some kind of ascension and you'll go to the fifth dimension. Like they have all this different terminology. But the core of the event that they're talking about is the same as this Bulgarian mystic from 1944. It's a bit strange because all those guys came so much later. Did they just copy their ideas from him? But then... when I looked into his works, they weren't translated.
Obscure, isn't it?
They weren't translated until very recently, and only a small portion of it's been translated.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the idea could have crept into those circles, but it is strange, the coincidental nature of it.
Yeah. And this is what some of the contactees were saying in the 1960s as well. So it's been a persistent idea in the fringe areas of occult knowledge across this vast areas of disciplines for quite a long time. The Earth will soon be swept by extraordinary rapid waves of cosmic electricity, he says. A few decades from now, beings who are bad and lead others astray will not be able to support their intensity. They will thus be absorbed by cosmic fire that will consume the bad that they possessed. Our mother, the Earth, will get rid of people that don't accept the new life. She will reject them like damaged fruit.
See, again, what do we have to accept?
This is what Stephen and Evan Strong said in that lecture like 3 years ago we went to.
It is,
where they said the CEOs and all the bad blokes aren't going to be able to handle the energy. Like that's how that. This is what this Bulgarian dude saying in 1944. A guy that can teleport to America and back and clearly drive a train.
He will clearly drive a train, which is a skill in itself, but he's not saying that the CEOs, he's just saying in general people that can't handle
that's
it.
That's true. The way that this new system stops bad people from existing, they can't reincarnate on the planet.
Oh, okay.
There's like a mechanism. He says the criminals will not be able to reincarnate on this planet. Only those who possess love will remain.
I don't buy that.
That's why you won't be coming back.
I'm happy not to come back. I'm really happy about that.
The earth will become blessed, but before this, there'll be huge sufferings. Again, he goes through...
We're going through it right now.
He goes through this wave that liquidates the karma of people. It's like literally he keeps describing a cosmic wave, an electrical wave, something that sweeps through our solar system and the rest of the cosmos.
It doesn't make sense. Like, if you believe in the concept of karma, you can't just simply have a cosmic wave come through and liquidate it and remove it from you.
Like, well, I mean, it makes sense in the idea that they can't reincarnate on Earth. It's like suddenly planet Earth has a new standard.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
And if you've got too much karma, sorry, you got to go to Xylon 4 with the slugs. You got to... you incarnate...
You go to the CEO planet.
Yeah, you either incarnate on a CEO planet, which would be pretty good, or the slug planet.
Would it? I don't know. There'd be a... There's some good CEOs out there, as I said. There's a lot of
you're a CEO, for God's sake. CEOs. Oh, my God. And then he mentions the mole people.
Oh, mole people.
In an indirect way. This is my inference.
Did they reincarnate?
Listen to this quote. He says that right at the end of this prophecy, he says, under the earth, something extraordinary is preparing itself. Something under the earth. A revolution that is grandiose and completely inconceivable will manifest itself soon in nature. It is the end of an epoch. A new order will substitute the old, an order in which love will reign on earth.
It's not a world I want to live in.
What if there's mole people?
I definitely don't want to live with the mole people.
What if they're hot mole people?
There's no hot mole people.
There might be.
They're all blind.
Look,
they're groping around in the dark.
They're not. It's not like they have a face that looks like a mole. It's they just live under the earth. That's why we call them mole people. But what if they're like perfect tens, all of them?
Okay, then I'll stay.
Yeah?
But I'll sorry for that.
What if I set you up with a hot mole person? They're all non-binary, by the way. That's the only downside.
No, I'm out.
Okay, so... The first thing this reminded me of, as I said earlier, this is all the stuff the contactees, the channelers, the New Agers have been going on about this bloody photon belt thing for decades now. I remember reading about this stuff when I was a teenager, that the photon belt was coming. We just came across this again when we did the last Plus episode,
yes,
reading Michael Saylor's book. That was from this contactee, this modern contactee. Her name's Elena Danan. She was rescued from a alien abduction by Greys in this ridiculous scenario where they do a Black Ops raid of the Greys spaceship
through the wall and
and rescue her.
Yeah.
And like the Navy SEALs take out Bin Laden. They do a similar thing. They take out all the Greys. She has this contact, Thor Hahn, which is this Pleiadian man god. And he told her in a recent communication that our star system is entering, quote, one of these, what's it called? A pocket of in the fabric of space-time. And he says the enemy and the Dark Ones know about it, and that's why they've surrendered. I will tell you more later. And so we spoke about, I didn't actually cover this on the last show, but this is another source where he's talking about this manifestation, this cosmic wave, this cloud that we're about to enter. Now, she asks, well, what happens when Earth crosses over into this high-density zone in the galaxy? He says it manifests as a change in consciousness as the perceptions, mental and physical, shift into a higher range. Physical symptoms can occur, he says. Those who have prepared their mind openly follow the wave, but those who are not ready and resist it, it translates for them by physical and mental suffering.
Okay.
It's very similar to what our Bulgarian friend was saying. Now, Saylor says that indeed this has been confirmed by scientists back in 2014 that indeed our solar system is about to enter a sizable interstellar cloud. They've given it a very scientific name. It's called the local fluff.
Fluff, a very scientific term.
There's an article from Science Direct. I'll link to it. It's called the local fluff. And apparently it's 30 light years wide. It's held together by a vast magnetic field. And as I was reading through the science article today, the biggest concern is that increase in magnetic energy, to put it in a very simple term.
And will that have any consequences, do they think?
They're worried about technology? No, they're worried about what it'll do to the Earth's climate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other concern was astronauts, because they'll be
exposed to high levels of radiation.
Yeah, there's basically much more radiation coming into our solar system.
So do they mean it'll get hotter, it'll get colder? They don't know.
It'll probably get hotter.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I like it when it's warm, so that's fine.
So he says this was first observed, this interstellar cloud was first observed in 1961 around the Pleiades constellation, and it was called the photon belt by certain observers. Now, this is what I've been referring to. This is the term that a lot of the contactee crowd has jumped on. There's this Noel Huntley, who's a PhD holder, who wrote an article in 2010 called The Photon Belt Encounter. It's at Bibliotheca Pleiades.
Oh, yes, yeah.
It's just full of nonsense. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is, yeah.
He actually talks, interestingly, though, about all these densities of the Earth that'll be created. So this is why, in his vision, why people will get left behind, because there'll be people stuck on third density, and there will be a version of the Earth that will go into the fourth density, and we'll be like, see you later. And everyone else will be stuck in the third. Like, you'll be stuck in the third. I'll be in the fourth.
So what, there'll just be some husk of your body lying around?
I'll just disappear. I'll be like the Bulgarian guy. I'll just disappear.
Good luck with that.
And I won't be in far away in distance, but I'll be far away in another dimension. And you'll be stuck here with
See, the irony is that you have no idea that it's a complete reversal of that situation. You're stuck here and I'm long gone.
No, man. Like,
I told you so.
Have fun with the mole people. Bigger. But amazing.
Use protection.
Speaking of the mole people, in this article by Noel Huntley, let me read a quote here. He says, an advanced civilization exists in the center of the Earth, but this particular civilization is on a parallel plane, so in another dimension,
yes,
which is reached only by entering electromagnetic corridors near the openings at the poles and certain other regions.
This is all the Sedona stuff.
Like Arizona.
Yep. Yeah, it's the same idea. It's this concept that there was an occultist by the name of David Miller, and he believes that there are these corridors, these tunnels of energy that essentially connect what he says is the fifth dimension to the third. I don't know what happened to the fourth, so let's ignore that. But essentially, you have these layers of reality on this planet.
Yeah.
And so all this stuff is going on in this alternative dimension. And occasionally, you can access it as people fall through these spaces where there's this opening of this corridor due to certain, you know, in some circumstances, it's been described that there's even minor tectonic plate movement. It's enough to supply energy to these corridors to allow them to open. And that's why people get sucked into them.
All very interesting. But the most interesting part of that quote is he says an advanced civilization exists in the center of the Earth. That's not mole people,
yeah,
I don't know what is.
I knew you were going for mole people.
Advanced.
Why does it have to be mole people, though? Why can't it just be inner Earth people?
Well, I mean, yeah, you can call them that. That's not what they are, though. They're mole people. They live underground.
We're all beginning to think you've got a bit of a mole person fetish, Ben.
I do have a mole person fetish. So, is there anything to this? It is weird. You've got this idea.
It's also crazy.
It's wild. It's crazy. But it's in so many different places. It's in the Ra, Law of One, channeled material. I've lost count of how many times I've come across this idea. And that's why I was so bamboozled that this Bulgarian guy, born in the 1800s, was yapping about it in the early
decades
20th century.
Yeah.
It's a bit strange. So is there anything to this idea? So that's when I transitioned to the work by Paul LaViolette. He wrote a book quite a few years ago called Earth Under Fire. And he begins by discussing a hidden side to astrology. So he believes that the zodiac signs, the astrological signs, contain a secret cipher that was encoded by an incredibly advanced ancient civilization. Now, I'll explain how this connects to the photon wave in a moment. But he says, there appears to be another side to astrology that we can only now uncover because of the advancement in science. We can only now understand it. And he says, look, regardless what you believe about planetary energies or, you know, the zodiac influencing your personality in your day, like, don't worry about that. Astrology's symbols, he says, convey a highly sophisticated astronomical and geological message. It's one that informs us and future generations about one of the most horrible disasters to afflict the human race. It's the occurrence of an explosion from our galaxy's core. He says, moreover, the Zodiac warns us that this tragedy will repeat.
Do you know, I was just thinking, I've heard something similar from reports of some abductees, like some really out there reports that have come from abductees that is ultimately, it's not from the center of our galaxy. Sorry, it's not from the center of our solar system. It's from the center of the galaxy, that at one point we're going to line up with that. And if we line up with that, it's going to essentially, it's like some intergalactic laser beam that will wipe us out.
Yeah. That's,
it's the same kind of thing.
Same concept. Again, once you...
From abductee stories.
Once you understand the template, you'll see it everywhere. He says, as history has shown, civilizations rise and fall. Advanced cultures are often separated from one another by long dark ages. We know that. So in the course of one of these dark ages, all the, you know, technical knowledge, most of it is lost, right? So a technically advanced body of knowledge wouldn't survive for many generations. And this is a question that, you know, many thinking minds have pondered. How do we retain knowledge and pass it on to a generation in 1,000 years into the future? How do you do it?
Well, stone is one answer, but obviously it's very, very difficult to put all those masses of information into stone. You've got to put it into something else that also something can be read. Like, it's no good putting all this important technical information onto an SSD, like a hard drive, and then expecting that they're going to have something that will be able to open it.
Exactly. So LaViolette says, by encrypting these ideas into a system of star constellations and myth, these ancient patriarchs could ensure that the content of their astrological cipher would be conveyed undistorted through the millennia.
That makes sense.
So it's quite ingenious if you think about it. And he points out the obvious problems of communicating with a culture in the future. It's supremely difficult. They may as well be alien, he says, because you don't know what language they're going to speak. You don't know what their numerical system is, what their base mathematics will be.
Just even what their culture is.
Their culture, how they understand things. So he uses the Pioneer 10 spacecraft that was launched back in 1972. You know, the one with the encoded gold.
Yeah, of course. Plaque. Yeah, and then was playing classical music. It's got a "We Are the People of Earth."
Yeah,
and all of our information.
I'll send you the picture that's in there, that's engraved on there, so you can throw that in the show notes, so people know what I'm referring to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. This and is, everyone will notice when they see it.
Yeah, LaViolette spends some time going through just how ingenious this whole thing is. Like, if you look at what's encoded in this diagram,
the non-binary people would be offended by this image.
They will be very offended because there's
mole,
a man,
the mole non-binary,
the mole people. The mole people don't approve of this entire episode, by the way. But if you look at this engraving, it encodes so much. It indicates the electrical wavelength of hydrogen atoms. It indicates that you need to use a binary system to measure what's there. It gives 21 centimeters as this standard unit of measurement and 0.704024 nanoseconds as the messenger's unit of time to measure what's in there. It encodes the location of our solar system in the galaxy. It gives the binary code for pulsations of radio pulsars. It's really incredible what's in there, because if you look at the radio pulsars, they provide an exact time when Pioneer 10 departed from Earth.
Oh, so you can use it as a way to pinpoint where Earth is?
Well, no, that's the something about the hydrogen key. You can calculate. It's so complicated. Yeah. But yeah, there is a way to locate our solar system, not our planet.
Right.
But I think then from other inferences, they'll be able to figure out where from planet Earth. And this pulsar diagram that they use from the hydrogen key, it tells you exactly when the spacecraft was launched. So right. It gives you a timestamp as well. It's actually ingenious. It's really brilliant. And he goes into great detail, which is beyond the scope of the show. But in his previous book before this, it was called Genesis of the Cosmos. And that's where he fully went into this unique idea that these 12 zodiac signs portray a metaphysical concept relating to a process occurring in nature. And the reason he mentions that spacecraft that we launched back in the 1970s is because it's basically the same concept of how to encode that information.
Oh, okay.
So we encoded all this information about us in this metal plate, and you have to make all these inferences and calculations about it. The only way you can figure it out is if you're particularly at a certain level of advancement as a species.
But also, though, you've got to have a little bit of chance going on there, because you've got to have it that plate lands on some populated planet somewhere.
It's got to be intercepted by, something intelligent enough to read it. But he claims what's been encoded in the Zodiac is the same idea. It has the same level of complexity and the same level of communication for the future, and the same level of advancement. It's highly technical and highly advanced.
Okay.
And only a culture that is suitably scientifically advanced would be able to understand it.
So you're saying it's hidden in the stars?
No, it's not in the stars. It's in the constellations. So you've got a palette in the sky, and through myth, they've said that, okay, this is a bull.
Oh.
This is Taurus. This is a bull.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is Pisces. So they've drawn the pictures, and the pictures stay with us through myth.
Yeah, right. Like that story of Orion, and you can see Orion's belt, and then you can actually see the constellation of Orion, and he's holding out his bow and arrow, and he's chasing Scorpius.
Yeah. It's like the stars aren't going anywhere. It's like you mentioned stone.
Yeah.
It's a good suggestion. Stars are even better.
Yeah.
Because stone can get lost and broken. So
Even if a star's destroyed, you still see its light for millions of years.
Exactly. So he says when these zodiac signs are properly arranged from the order they normally present along the ecliptic, they portray a coherent theory of physical creation, he says. They begin by describing fundamental processes taking place in the ether, the invisible primordial substance that fills all space, and they finish by describing how this active ether matrix configures itself into subatomic particles, the building blocks that make up our physical universe. They show how matter and energy first came into being eons ago, and how they have since continued to come into being through a process of continuous creation. A physics of cosmogenesis, similar to that described by the Zodiac, was actually developed by Western science in the 1970s. So this is where you can tell why he's saying this is in my previous book, because it was very, very in-depth. Basically, what was put forward in the 1970s was a theory of sub-quantum kinetics. Now, it's beyond the scope of my knowledge to explain it like you're five. I can try. It came about, he says, from observations on how ordered patterns and forms emerge and persist in open systems. And I'll link to some science articles on this. It's very complicated, but the basic idea is that patterns and order emerge in the physical universe from some kind of, what's the term? Some kind of
like a structure?
Subatomic ether.
Okay.
It's like order comes, naturally emerges in nature. We know that.
Well, it does, yeah. Look at the geometric structures you find.
But the foundation of matter and that the structure of that order,
it's the same.
Comes from, he's almost saying another dimension. It's like what Greg Little was talking about on the last show, how there's this other side that manifests as plasma. They're talking about the same thing. He says this sub-quantum kinetics approach views the physical universe as emerging from an active lifelike ether whose constituents continually enter and leave our physical plane of existence as they react and irreversibly transform along a fourth dimension. He says one of the advantages of this approach is that it allows order to be spontaneously created and material particles to continuously emerge in empty space out of an ever-present zero-point energy subquantum noise. He says it offers a creation alternative to the Big Bang theory. So
that's a lot to swallow.
Big Bang is just this idea that, like Greg was saying on the last show, it's this bucket with everything in it and boom, it explodes and all the matter goes out and that's where all the matter is.
Yeah.
He's saying, no, matter can be created spontaneously in the universe.
From another dimension.
From this other dimension. Another idea to think about it is, you know how we've looked at the research that shows electrical, the kind of morphogenetic fields create the scaffolding and the structure. And
the human body, for example.
And the physical body follows that's energetic structure.
Which is possibly an explanation as to why people have phantom, limb syndrome.
Yeah,
it's the
same idea, but on a universal scale. It's like a...
Oh, that's kind of, yeah.
It's a unifying field theory.
Mm, it's interesting.
And it's freaking hard to wrap your head around.
Oh, of course it would be. Absolutely.
But
you know what that then starts to lean towards, though? The simulation hypothesis. that it's all got a structure, like it's all programmed in some way to exist.
I mean, yeah, you could go down that direction. It's beyond the scope of this. But if he thought that was complicated, wait until he tries to connect it all to the tarot.
Oh, no, bring it.
So
we're up for it.
He finds this subquantum kinetics idea in the 1970s, and he starts researching tarot in 1975, and he realized that the first 11 pictograms of the tarot express a science of physical creation that's identical to this subquantum kinetics theory. He said this indicated not only that there was an ancient predecessor to subquantum kinetics, but also that whoever designed the tarot must have had advanced knowledge of both physics and a nonlinear system behavior.
What? How?
So he believes that this subquantum kinetics is accurate. It exactly explains creation of matter and life in the universe. He claims that the tarot symbols, when organized correctly, clearly show this process.
What, so is he talking about things like the major arcana? Does that somehow...
Let me continue. He says, later I found that this physics... Oh, sorry. He says, I discovered that astrology also shared this scientific advancement in the 12 signs of the zodiac. And when properly rearranged, present this physics as well. He said, later I found that this physics is also encoded in ancient myths. So he says it appears in Egyptian myths, it's in Sumerian myths, it's in the Greek story of Zeus, the creation of Atlantis, it's Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, it's all in there. So it must be incredibly old. It must be from an incredibly advanced civilization, because we know that the zodiac is incredibly old.
Yes.
And the tarot comes from that. The tarot is all connected. It must predate the beginning of recorded history. So let me send you, for the show notes perhaps, one of these scans of what he's talking about. And I just want to mention this briefly because I'm worried about getting bogged down in this because it's very complicated.
Oh, I can imagine.
And you kind of need to see it to understand what he's talking about. So, for example, Taurus is a source of the head of the etherons that accumulate at a high reaction potential to constitute a reserve of etheric energy. So he goes through each of the zodiac signs and he explains how this relates to subquantum kinetics. You understand what I'm saying? Like,
look, I see where you're going. I mean, I don't understand the mechanics of it though.
Yeah.
It's like,
oh, okay. Let me make it really simple.
Because etherons are not a subatomic particle. Is that something that he's created?
No, this is a separate thing. This is how to think of it. The zodiac symbols, when broken down, are a pictorial representation of the subquantum kinetic process.
Sure. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So it's like you went into some kind of hidden temple in ancient Egypt and it was showing how, electrons orbit the nuclei.
I'm wrong. Etherons are subatomic particles.
See, I knew you were wrong. How could you doubt any of this?
They relate to mass.
So you understand the general concept though?
Yes, I do.
The zodiac is pictorially representing this subquantum kinetic theory that didn't emerge until the 1970s in the West. So there's something encoded in the zodiac. Now, the problem is the arrangement of the zodiac along the ecliptic arrangement that we all know, like the order of the zodiac, is wrong. He claims it's all jumbled around.
So we have to somehow unjumble it to reveal a mathematical code or...
The reason it's jumbled is because it's a cipher.
Oh.
So the people that encoded this, they had to do it in a way so that it was protected, like the knowledge was protected.
So obviously a sufficiently advanced civilization will be able to understand that and decode it.
And perhaps someone that's initiated would be able to decode it. So he claims the key to unlock the cipher of the zodiac is the Sphinx and the Tarot. So the Sphinx is a formulation of a bull, like the hindquarters of a bull.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the four parts of a lion, the wings of an eagle, and the head of a human. Now, each of these represent one of the so-called fixed signs of the zodiac. So you've got Taurus as the bull, Leo's the lion, obviously, Scorpio's the scorpion, and Aquarius is the water bearer. The eagle form isn't... He connects that to Scorpius because astrologers have often made that association, like the eagle is connected to Scorpio. It's also been said that the Sphinx is the key to the occult. It's a well-known kind of terminology. And it's the deciphering of a riddle. It's the, remember, even
the riddle
cases,
of the Sphinx.
Yeah, the riddle of the Sphinx. Yeah. The Sphinx is the key to unlocking a secret. The ancient practice of placing sphinxes at the gates of cities and temples. Again, he says that underscores the significance of gaining entrance to something protected, something secret. He says the word gate in Kabbalistic lore signifies a cryptographic key. So the Sphinx hieroglyph also gives us a hint, he says, as to which zodiac signs to place at the beginning and end of this structure of the zodiac. He says, in the deciphered arrangement, the order of these four signs of the Sphinx remains unchanged from the order they normally have along the ecliptic that we know. So he basically uses the tarot then as the second key to unlock the cipher. So the Sphinx is telling you, okay, you've got to order it by, you know, the bull, Leo, Scorpio, Aquarius, that gives you these four points to order it. And the tarot is the second part of the key, which gives you the metaphysical principles, because the tarot gives you like polarities and male and female like associations with each zodiac principle.
Right, okay.
So he says using that, you can basically, I'm just going to cut this really short, you can form the correct structure of the zodiac, right?
And then in doing so, what does that reveal?
Okay, so you've got, of the ways you can order the zodiac, there's like 500 million possibilities, mm-hmm. right? But only a small fraction have perfect symmetry when you apply the tarot ideas of the masculine and feminine and the polarities plus and minus of each of the zodiac signs. He says he can boil it down to a small amount. And out of those, that out of those billions, and you boil it down to that small fraction, only one combination starts with the sign of Taurus. And he's got this whole chapter of why it has to start with Taurus. It's got to do with the horns and the outward motion of the bull. It's like, it. But basically there's this one combination that seems to be this outlier. Like mathematically it has to be this combination.
And is that kind of like a flag to a civilization decoding it?
Well, when you line out this combination, it shows the process of this subquantum kinetic creation of life. That's what he's saying. It's like this universal theory of creation in quantum physics is encoded in the ancient zodiac. It's pretty wild.
It is wild, yes.
Now, he says this, so this reveals, the zodiac reveals this quantum kinetic creation of life, but what else does it show? Well, it seems to show some kind of fundamental energy gradient in our galaxy. So Leo and Aquarius, they're opposite each other in this zodiac. They appear, he says, to be indicating temperature polarity in space. So astrologers, they traditionally associate Leo with warmth, passion, generosity, and Aquarius is associated with frigidity, being impersonal, being intellectual. So Leo's ruling planet is the sun, obviously very hot. Aquarius is linked with the ruling planet of Saturn, which at the time was the farthest away planet. And it's obviously cold. It's further away from the sun. So a similar temperature polarity is suggested in the human body parts that are associated with zodiac signs.
Mm-hmm.
So Leo is the heart, and that's the warmest part of your body. And the lowest temperature is Aquarius, which is associated with your ankles and, you know, your feet. So it's like, all of this matches up in a strange way, but incredibly, measurements of the intensity of microwave background radiation coming from deep space have revealed precisely this kind of temperature gradient extending across the heavens. So the hottest...
So as above, as below.
The hottest microwave temperature is located near Leo, the literal constellation in the sky. The coolest microwave temperature is located near Aquarius.
Okay, that is a very interesting coincidence.
What the hell's going on there?
Mm.
That, he says, this is astounding because it takes really sophisticated electronic equipment
to be able to understand that and measure it.
To measure that and detect that. Like microwave background radiation wasn't detected until 1955, but it was refined through radio telescopes for, you know, decades after. Like you can't even measure it from the ground. There's a group that did it in Berkeley in the 80s or something, and they had to use a U-2 spy plane to get the measurements, because even if you're on the top of a mountain, it all fluctuates.
So what do they use now? Satellites, obviously.
Yeah, you use satellites now. So, and then you get into this idea of the galactic center. So the galactic center is, well, our solar system is 23,000 light years from the galactic center, and we're on, you know, one of those spiral arms of the galaxy. And the outline of the galaxy's arm is visible to the naked eye, but we can't actually see the galactic center because it's obscured by cosmic dust. But this central location, he says, is in the zodiac. The zodiac, if you align it, if you organize it once it's been decrypted, it points directly to the center of the galaxy. And let me explain why. He says, of the 12 astrological signs, the glyphs for Scorpio and Sagittarius, they're the only ones that have arrows in them. So you've got two arrows, right? When you organize them by the decrypted sequence, those two constellations are basically facing one another. They're pointing at each other. So you've got two arrows pointing in a direction, almost as if they're like pointing to a spot somewhere. So the orange-colored star Gamma Sagittarii comes closest to the galactic center location. And the ancient artisans, he says, of the constellation chose this star to represent the tip of the archer's arrow. Now, the star representing the foot of the serpent bearer to the west of the galactic center appears as the next closest star to the galactic center. This is followed by G Scorpii, Lambda Scorpii, Upsilon Scorpii, and they trace out the end of the scorpion's tail. When lines are added to connect these three tail stars with the galactic center, Scorpius starts to look like an arrow, like the shape of an upward arching arrow.
Pointing to?
Well, he says it looks like the galactic center is pointing from Scorpio's stinger, like the edge of the scorpion stinger is actually the galactic center. So again, when you organize the zodiac by this decrypted, in this decrypted way, he says you get this really interesting thing that happens. So Sagittarius appears to be shooting his arrow towards Scorpius in this new alignment. Ancient Greek mythology tells us he's taking aim at the heart of the scorpion. But he says, look, if you project the trajectory of that arrow, so Sagittarius, it's slightly missing.
Oh, that's why I got that fable wrong. So you're right, it's Sagittarius that's got the, it's not Orion, it's Sagittarius that's chasing Scorpius.
Well, I mean, this is all organized based on his decryption.
Yeah.
But when that arrow's fired, it's missing Scorpion's heart by about 5 degrees.
Going somewhere else.
Yeah, the heart is definitely Scorpio's tail, so it should be hitting it, right? It should be hitting it because the arrow is saying, here's the center of the galaxy, boing, but it misses it by 5 degrees. So here's where it gets weird. When was it lining up? When would that arrow perfectly point to the center of the galaxy?
Can I take a guess? Was it somewhere around 10 to 12,000 years ago?
15,870,000 years ago. Would have been the date 13,865 BCE. So he's saying that this code in the zodiac, much like the spacecraft that was launched in the 1970s with the golden etchings telling when it was launched, it's the same thing. It's saying this is when we created this cipher.
So could that suggest that there was an advanced culture that created this because they knew something was coming?
Well, you know what makes this even more incredible? He's saying, look, this points exactly to the center of the galaxy. You can't see the center of the galaxy. It's obscured by dust. It wasn't until 1917 you had Harlow Shapley who attempted to locate it. And the only way he could do it was to use other clusters that were nearby and make like 3D calculations of where it kind of should be. He got pretty close. He was off by 3.3 degrees of an arc. The zodiac, by the process that I've just explained, where the arrow is pointing to the center at the end of the scorpion's tail, that is 8 times more accurate as pointing to directly at the center of our galaxy.
So whoever created it was obviously sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly technically advanced. So,
but at a time where we shouldn't have been, according to modern history.
Our ancient predecessors knew this location by some means. But then he has another question. Were they technically advanced to the point where they had, you know, advanced radio telescopes, which is how we've located it now? Or was the core of our galaxy just super bright? 15,000.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a possibility as well.
So bright that it would shine through all that dust, or maybe that dust wasn't there. So if you look at the core today, it's Sagittarius A. This is what we know about it. It's kind of mind-blowing. It's a single body. So the core of our galaxy is a single body, estimated to be about 1 million times as massive as the sun. It's the most massive celestial object in the galaxy by far. It generates a fierce wind of cosmic ray electrons and protons rushing outward at a very close to the speed of light. And on their way, they emit electromagnetic radiation, gamma ray emission. Nearby gas clouds are warmed by this energetic blast, and they emit radiation that's equivalent to 10 million to 30 million of our suns. Mind-blowing energy coming out of this thing. Now, astronomers today, if you look up Sagittarius A, they reckon it's a black hole. LaViolet says, there's no way this thing's a black hole. Like, there's problems because all the evidence suggests that gas isn't being sucked towards the galactic center. It's being pushed outwards. And if a black hole was at the center of our galaxy gobbling up material, wouldn't it just devour the entire galaxy?
But could it be possible that this aligns with his idea of, like, it being a way for something to materialize in our reality? Is that what this is?
That's like, kind of what it's getting to, because he says whoever coded this zodiac constellation, they didn't portray the heart of the galaxy as a region of annihilation, like a black hole. He says it's one of creation. It's literally the creation engine of the galaxy. It's the wellspring. It gives birth to all the cosmic matter in our galaxy.
Is that possible with every galaxy?
Yes, but here's the thing. He says this creation center at the center of the galaxy can erupt with such force that it can affect every single world in those spiral arms of the galaxy.
So it's like a volcano. We're waiting for some cosmic Krakatoa.
The zodiac cryptogram, he says, appears to tell of one such deadly outburst that issued from our own galactic center not too long ago. And there's another one on the way. We're going to find out more in our Plus extension. I'm going to reveal this strange connection with this idea of explosions from the center of the galaxy, how it's tied in with ancient Hopi lore, how it connects to stories from Babylon and Sumeria, and how it connects to this Bulgarian weirdo from the 1940s and all these insane channelers from the 1970s and 1980s.
Is there some group that's trying to warn humanity about this coming calamity?
Maybe. I don't know what's going on. It's bizarre. I'm never going to look at the zodiac again in the same way. It's super bizarre.
No, I must say I'm extremely intrigued about this because I've always kind of just, you know, thrown aside the zodiac and gone, oh, well, you know, that's just, you know, a certain, you know, superstition, you know, just ignore that. But I didn't realize that there could actually be something really important held inside it.
Remember Robert Schock's idea that there was this massive solar outburst in the past?
Yes.
And people would have seen strange plasma outbursts in the sky and they would have had to have...
And that was around 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, they would have had to have hidden in their homes because of the radiation and they wouldn't be able to emerge because it would just be too dangerous.
And it would have killed people.
LaViolet goes into the same idea, but he fully explains why the sun would do that. And it's got to do with these galactic explosions.
Oh, so it kind of like pulses in response to the event?
Well, when you have this galactic core periodically just going and creating all this matter and energy and sending it out into the galaxy, all this dust and radiation and energy ultimately comes into our solar system.
Well, it's like a storm.
And the sun just goes bananas. And what you see in the sky, there's a great section coming up where he describes some of the insane shit you'll see in the sky. And then
does that show up, obviously, in Ancient Legends?
Yeah, and then he compares it to Ancient Legends. Mm. It's like the Eye of Sauron staring down, quite literally the Eye of Sauron staring down at you in the sky.
Cooking you at the same time.
And yes, cooking your testicles to where you have no swimmers left. Nothing left to impregnate the hot mole people.
Well, the mole people are fine because they're underground.
Exactly. That's why they're advanced. That's why they're still hot.
No, they're not hot. They're all inbred, so they're gross.
And the evidence of why this coming galactic explosion wave changes humanity into
mole people,
the sixth race. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole idea that underpins what the Bulgarians said and what some of these other New Age weirdos say, that it'll change humankind. I'll explain that as well in the Plus extension. Head on over to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus if you want to sign up and see where all this crazy stuff goes. And of course, we've got some miraculous stories coming out of Sedona as well.
And people being sucked into Stonehenge. Literally sucked into the stone.
Into the stone. Is that what happens to our listeners in Sedona? Like we never hear from them. They sign up and then we never hear from them.
That is gone. It's just disappeared. Another dimension.
Is that what's going
on? Yeah, like obviously the crystal power plant that is allegedly underneath Sedona has some malfunction and it opens up a couple of portals. People fall in and that's the end of them. I don't know where they go.
Mole people.
You just end up a mole person.
You just wake up. It's just some hot mole chick in a bikini. It's like, well, you found us. There's 1,000 of us mole women and we have no males left.
Will you stop it with your fantasies?
We've been waiting for one such as you to return to the mole kingdom and give us your much needed vitality.
You've given us a lot of thought. We're all disturbed.
Sign up for Plus. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus today. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single week and you get exclusive shows that come out on Tuesdays. Plus members get a higher quality audio version of the show as well. You also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you're on MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalogue and everything we've put out in the past as well. Sign up today.
Make sure also you check out store.mysteriousuniverse.org. I just launched a whole heap of new products. There's new designs coming too, but with our new designs, the current MU logo, it's all just been relaunched on a range of new products. So go and check it out.
How many people have bought the MU lamp?
Oh, I didn't launch the lamp.
Oh, you didn't launch the lamp.
I thought about it. I thought the shits and giggles that I just launched an MU lamp. Then I thought, no. Although there is a Bigfoot lamp. And the reason why I put that in there is because Bigfoot pillows, before I closed the old store, were just going at the shelf. Yeah, like they were just walking out the door.
The best seller.
So there is, for the lucky punters out there, if you really are that crazy, check out the Bigfoot lamp. It's in there somewhere. I won't tell you exactly where.
Even people that hate us were buying the Bigfoot pillows.
Yeah, they were.
Like our greatest enemies. They were just logging in and buying the Bigfoot pillows. Whatever.
True story. They actually did.
We win in the end. Everyone wins. They get a Bigfoot pillow. We get their money. So yeah, check out the store, store.mysteriousuniverse.org. And yeah, make sure you sign up for Plus as well. That's a wrap for this free show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Plus extension, great to have you.